JSA in the 90s. This episode, an interview with creators Matt Wagner and John K. Snyder III on the 1999 Dr. Midnight miniseries. Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of JSA in the 90s, the podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and JSA-related comics from the 1990s. We're part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed and a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, the Irredeemable Shag. Now, if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. And if you're new around here, welcome to the JSA Brownstone. For our new listeners, each month, this show celebrates the Justice Society and related characters as published throughout the 1990s. So far, we've covered the beloved 1992 Justice Society of America ongoing series by Len Strazewski and Mike Parabek, and we're currently in the middle of our coverage of the fantastic 1991 JSA 8-issue miniseries. Along the way, we also spotlight individual members of the JSA and explore what they were up to during the decade. Now, for this episode, we have got a very special treat. Joining me today are writer Matt Wagner and artist John K. Snyder III, the powerhouse creative team behind the critically acclaimed 1999 Dr. Midnight miniseries from DC Comics, along with countless other fantastic comics over the years. Now, we'll be diving into the creation of this atmospheric reinvention of Dr. Midnight, discussing creative collaboration, visual storytelling, behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. And Matt and John were an absolute joy to talk with, as you're about to hear. And as a special bonus, this interview is also available in video form on the Fire and Water Podcast Network YouTube channel. During the interview, you'll see a showcase of John K. Snyder III's incredible artwork from the Dr. Midnight series. I'll include a link in the show notes for that YouTube episode, but you can also find that same artwork featured on our website in the image gallery for this episode. Now, I'd also like to give a huge thanks to some friends of the show and fans of this exceptional miniseries who helped me develop the questions. I crowdsourced ideas for questions from Dr. Ange, Alex Osias, Robert Junker, David Steele, Peter Watson, Dave Tomko, and Michael Bailey. Thanks to you guys for your contributions that helped make this interview as great as it actually was. Now, quick heads up before we begin. This is a candid and unfiltered conversation about the comic book creative process, so there is a little bit of adult language. So if you're listening out loud or you're around younger ears, you may want to grab your headphones. All right, now settle in for a fantastic conversation with two legendary creators. Matt Wagner, John K. Snyder III, thank you both so much for being here to talk about your work on the Dr. Midnight miniseries published in 1999. So excited to have you guys here.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Thanks for having us here. Thank you.
Absolutely. We here at the Justice Society Presents podcast, and we're specifically, I'm doing JSA in the 90s, huge fans of y'all's work and huge fans of this Dr. Midnight series. So the chance to talk to you both, I know the people at home are going to just go crazy for this. So this is great. So let's actually take a step back. Let's start with early days for a minute. Let's knock out a little bit of history here. So how did each of you, this is for both of you, how did each of you first get interested in reading comics when you were a kid? And how did you first encounter the JSA characters? Why don't we start with you, Matt?
Well, I know a bit of John's history too, and I'd say both of us were kind of doomed for this lifestyle. I was an only child, and my mom was an English teacher, and I grew up kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and before there was any video entertainment. We had a black and white TV that got four stations. So my mom was always encouraging me to read, and unlike a lot of English teachers, she was an English teacher, and unlike a lot of English teachers of her generation, she didn't mind that I was reading comics, so long as I was reading. I read other stuff too, but again, since there was no video entertainment, I drew to entertain myself, and comics were that perfect synthesis of both reading and visuals. And, you know, my mom thought I would grow out of them. instead, I grew into them. But my parents had a school memories book from when I was a kid, one of those folder deals, you know, where you could put your school photo and your projects and shit. And on the back of the grade school years, it had a thing that said, what I want to be when I grow up. And one year I wrote astronaut, and that was the year they landed on the moon when every kid wanted to be an astronaut. And literally every other year I wrote comic book writer. I wrote writer because I assumed at that point whoever wrote them drew them too. I didn't quite realize it was usually a team effort. But as I said, doomed for this life.
How did you first come across the JSA?
I would say it was probably in, well, two sources. One time my parents had gone away on a vacation. Since I was an only child, they would occasionally leave me with family members and have a, you know, a date weekend. And they came back with a copy of Jules Feiffer's The Great Comic Book Heroes. The first comics history book I'd ever seen. I lost my freaking mind. Just like, oh my God, here it is in book form, you know. But then once DC started doing those 100-page spectaculars in the 70s, and they would include a lot of Golden Age reprint stuff in there, that really kind of expanded my awareness of these Golden Age characters. Plus, my parents were of that era. They were World War II era. My dad was in World War II. They were slightly older by the time I was born. And so I had kind of what I call an inherited nostalgia for that time period, those characters, etc.
That's fantastic. I remember when I was young, I was reading probably an All-Star Squadron or something, and Alan Scott happened to be on the page, and my mom walks by and goes, "Hey, that's the Green Lantern I remember," which one of those kind of, like you said, shared memories. So, yep. John, what about you?
You know, a lot of parallel lines there as far as my interest in comics as a kid. I mean, I just took to comics immediately, you know, as a source of reading. Again, different era. I mean, it was just a few channels on TV, and the comics were, you know, just automatically drawn to comics and reading the stories. And my parents were totally fine with it. So, you know, there's what photos of me from when I was a kid. And I mean, like when I was first walking, I'm like holding a comic book. The comic book, the comic is almost as big as I am in a couple of years. Really, it's really funny. It's like, now I had a younger brother and sister, and here I am sitting at the dining room table, you know, they're kind of playing. I'm reading a comic. You know, here's me out walking around with the family. I am somehow holding a comic. We're out in the middle of the snow. I am somehow still holding a comic, you know? And
security blanket.
Yeah, really, pretty much so. And I just was, I was just automatically drawn to just that, you know, here's a story. And it got me reading really quickly, too. Mm-hmm. I immediately picked up on that. And I was very fortunate because my dad's younger brothers were really into the early days of like Marvel and DC, specifically Marvel. So they had piles of comics around. So I was reading all their stuff. So everywhere I went, I kind of would gravitate toward wherever the comics happened to be in the house. You know, my grandmother had a stack of comics for some of my visiting cousins on my mom's side. And I would always gravitate toward that. And that was not so much Marvel, but like Gold Key, Archie, Classics Illustrated. It didn't matter. I'd read everything. And same thing, one of my uncles, they both actually like to dabble in drawing, like really mostly humorous type cartoony stuff. And they were drawn on notebook paper. So I picked up on that right away, started trying to draw stories on notebook paper. Didn't care that it was notebook paper. I was already trying to figure out how to tell stories as quickly as I could. By the time I was in third grade, I actually was doing little stories. And again, I'd seen the Feiffer book that Matt mentioned, and Feiffer mentioned that he had put together his own comics and stapled them together. And his drawing was very crude. So it was actually very encouraging. It's like, oh, okay. It can look like, it doesn't have like, to look
it's,
like.
It's fine for it to look like that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so that was a big inspiration as well. But I think that somewhere my mom saved, like when I was in kindergarten, it was like something called a health book that we were supposed to do in class. And it's this stapled like manila paper, and it's just like a little story, and it's stapled together. And I mean, I was just automatically, I'm like, I have got to try to figure out how to tell a story. And it wasn't so much I was focusing on the writing as I was focusing on trying to tell a story sequentially as quickly as possible, as soon as I could figure it out. You know, that part of it really was really what drew me to it, so to speak.
I want to follow up on a couple things John said there. So Classics Illustrated, again, my mom was an English teacher. And yeah, in those days, this is mid-60s, at the point of purchase at the checkout at the grocery store, where now we have National Enquirer and Us Magazine and that kind of shit, there was a rack of Classics Illustrated all the time. And she would buy me those constantly. So my first exposure to Shakespeare, to Robert Louis Stevenson, to Mark Twain, to et cetera, you know. Mm-hmm. But when we both say that there was not much video entertainment, specifically, there was no comic book stuff. Like, there was The Adventures of Superman, yep, and there was the 60s Batman show, nothing else.
Right.
You know? I mean, you know, eventually they started creeping into Saturday morning cartoons a bit, but there were no, the superheroes were noticeably absent, you know.
Except comics.
Yeah, except for comics, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, John, how did you first encounter the JSA?
Well, again, because I was getting exposed to all these different comics that my uncles had, and some of the books that my grandmother had in the collection of my cousins, I would look at all the ads, you know, that, and in DC, they had some of the DC comics, they would have the ads for some of those early Justice League of America comics, where they would have the crossover, and there would be this mysterious group, the Justice Society, that was from the past. And yeah, I was like, who are these guys?
Yeah, you know? Right, right. And why are some of them named the same?
Yeah. Who are these? And, you know, I have to say, I was immediately attracted to Dr. Midnight even then. I just thought, wow, that guy's kind of cool because he's, you know, he's solid black. You know, part of him is, you know, there's no shading or anything. He's like straight black arms, the head, the goggles.
Kind of the way John looks all the time, as you can see.
But the thing is, you couldn't, you know, just because you saw the ad, I never saw the actual comics.
Those were tantalizing cock teases, man. They were just like, I want to see it so bad.
So the same thing as Matt, when, again, the Pfeiffer book kind of introduced me, but also, and I know Matt has discussed this as well, the Steranko History of Comics book had a whole chapter on the JSA with the covers, and it was like, holy cow. Man, I'd love to see those. And there was another book, a series of articles. It was all prose, called All in Color for a Dime. Mm. And it was a series of essays. And there was a chapter on the JSA in that book. And it had some color plates reproducing some of the classic Golden Age covers.
Who put that together, dude? Do you remember? Was that Dick Lupoff or was it Ron Goulart?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
It was Dick Lupoff. Okay. Yeah.
They had like a, you know, it was like Harlan Ellison and a whole bunch of different people wrote. I think Don Thompson, you know, wrote about different like time. And anyway, JSA, I believe, was a subject in there.
Yeah,
same thing. When DC, there in the very early 70s, started doing the 100-page super spectaculars, I specifically, the issue, the Justice League issue that reprinted the Justice Society versus the Justice Society of Evil, was like gold. That was just, when that came out and I got a copy of that, I just thought that was the greatest thing, you know? So that was my major first exposure to the JSA, you know, to actually read a whole JSA story. And boy, I still think I have it somewhere here. I still love that book.
And again, that book that John mentioned, which was you know, basically historical essays, All in Color for a Dime, it stood out in the crowd because there just weren't history books about comics. There was the Jules Pfeiffer book, and then this one was kind of the next one on the shelves. And all of us, you know, that were hungry for comics in those days and trying to understand comics history, boy, we sucked that thing up with a spoon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, yeah, it really, like Matt said, I mean, it stood out, you know.
Yep.
So I recommend it if you've never had a chance to look at it, All in Color for a Dime. So.
Hey, kids today have no clue what it was like back then, right? I mean, because everything's at the fingertips now. Everything.
I try and describe to my son how the mere thought that there would ever be an X-Men movie, much less that it would be pretty good and that it would turn into a giant franchise, unthinkable. It was just like, no, that's never going to happen. You know,
blows my mind. My 84-year-old father knows who Matt Murdock is, which I never would have imagined that was possible, right? So you guys have been working together for a long time. How did you first start working together?
John, you want to?
Well, what happened was I've been in comics for about a couple of years. I've been working on my own series, Fashion and Action, over Eclipse, and a series called The Prowler with Tim Truman. And during that period, I saw that Kimiko was doing a Johnny Quest comic, which was, again, you're talking about early influences. Johnny Quest was huge, you know, and again, it stood out. There was absolutely nothing like it. So when Kimiko announced they were going to do a series, I was booked, but I wanted to try to figure out a way to do at least like maybe a short story or something. So I sent a proposal to Kimiko, and Diana Schutz was the editor in chief at the time, and she wrote back. And she said they had a artist book, but artist and writer team already booked, but would I be interested in a gallery piece? So I was, you know, that was awesome. So I did a gallery piece with, you know, Johnny Quest and Race, Yeti attacking them or whatever. And I loved doing that. And that was great. But when I got the artwork back from Diana after it was published, there was a little sticky note on the tissue overlay asking if I'd be interested in working with Matt Wagner on Grendel. And so that's how that started, you know. So I got to admit, I was familiar with Grendel, but I wasn't that familiar with it. At the time, I knew that this was with the Christine Spar run. that Matt was doing. And I thought, oh, that must be the connection, because I've been doing this all female action series, Fashion in Action. And I thought, oh, this has got something to do with the Christine Spar character. They must have an interest in me drawing Christine Spar. And I remember calling Matt for the first time. And I said, so this is about drawing Christine Spar. He's like, nah, we're killing her off.
And I thought, what? Which tends to happen in Grendel. Grendels don't last very long.
Yeah. I was like, wow, this guy is edgy, man. I immediately just was like, wow, I'm really looking for, I got to work with this guy, you know, because
after my first Grendel story, Kimiko asked me to make it an ongoing monthly. And my idea was, okay, the only way I can keep an ongoing monthly interesting for myself is if I continually keep reinventing it. So I keep reinventing the character. So it got to a point where I decided I'm going to make a big jump and push this far into the future. And that's where John came on board. And we were, John, what year was it we were in San Diego together? Do you remember
that
what year?
That was 1987.
So 1987, we were at San Diego, and Jay Geldof, who was going to work with John on the project, was there as well. This is when San Diego, you know, wasn't the giant media fest that it is now. It was still a comic book convention.
Right.
And it was at the other smaller venue, not the big one down on the waterfront that it is now. And we took off from the con and we went down the street to Wendy's and we got some lunch, and I sat there and kind of gave them the Reader's Digest version of what I had in mind. And they were both just like, I can't believe you're telling me this. This is crazy crap, you know? But it's all in the future, and the Pope is a vampire, and you know.
Yep. So yeah, that was the beginning of it for sure.
That was, yeah, and then we did. That was a 10-issue run. So we got very familiar with working together.
That's fantastic. And obviously the friendship continues today. I mean, you guys haven't missed a beat, clearly staying in touch. So let's talk about your work on Dr. Midnight, right? So the Dr. Midnight miniseries, 3-issue miniseries. So first off, we got to ask, settle this once and for all, how on earth do you pronounce Dr. Cross's first name? I have heard Peter, I've heard Pieter, I've heard Petter, I've heard everything. Well, how do you say it?
Okay, the official pronunciation, because it is a Dutch right. spelling of the name Peter, it's Peter. So it's almost an A, but it's still an E.
Peter.
Not quite that long of an A. Peter. It's still an E. There's still an E lurking in there, right? Now, that said, when I was working on it, I was pronouncing it Peter, because I named him after Peter DeVries, the Mentat character from Dune. And specifically in the David Lynch version, they pronounce it Peter. So I was going for naming him after Peter DeVries, who's a human computer, so he's real smart.
Oh, yeah.
And then the last name Cross to lend some holiness to his, some selflessness to his actions. Because we very, very, very much wanted to establish that this guy is a superhero doctor. He's not just a second-rate Batman. He's a doctor first and foremost. So that was the source of the name. Officially, it's Peter. In my mind, it's Peter. So you can call him whatever the hell you want.
Well, you folks at home, as you listen to this podcast, continue to over the course of the next several years, I guarantee you, even though Matt Wagner just told me how to say it, I'm going to get it wrong. So understand that. So how did the whole miniseries come about? And when did each of you get involved in the project?
Well, it's kind of started with John. So John, you go ahead.
Well, when Matt and I were working on Grendel, you know, we had an immediate rapport. I enjoyed working with Matt so much, and I really wanted to do something with him afterwards, after Grendel. And so I had talked to him about the possibility of working on something over at DC.
And this is when everybody was reinventing DC characters.
Right. Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. I mean,
in the flowing aftermath of Dark Knight, it was like everybody wanted to have their shot at redefining a character like Dark Knight did.
Right. So, yeah, to put it into context, this is like I had finished my work on Grendel. Probably it was, I believe it was like early 89. And I had discussed the possibility of doing something with Matt. And it was kind of a combination of things, because I had also just started working at DC on Suicide Squad. And I had also had the good fortune to run into Archie Goodwin a few times in my early years at conventions and talked about working with him. He was at Marvel at the time, but then he had gone over to DC as well. And I had kind of talked to Archie about the possibility of working on something. And I had brought up the possibility of working with Matt. And, you know, Matt and I would talk about the possibility of working on a project. And on top of that, I was also getting involved in starting a adaptation of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for Classics Illustrated over at First Comics.
Which was amazing, by the way.
Speaking of Classics Illustrated, Illustrated.
Yeah. and kind of give this more context. Like Matt said, this was like a really great period because especially DC, you know, DC had just had, like he said, in 85, you'd had 85, 86, you'd had Dark Knight and then Watchmen. And DC was very open to new interpretations of their characters. The Batman movie was getting ready to come out. I mean, it was a really hot period, I think. And also creatively, getting back to the classics, there was a new opening to do a new format, what they called a prestige format at the time, which was kind of stiff covers, almost like a cardboard type covers with glossy interior and full painted art. And full painted art interiors was just getting introduced. And specifically at DC, for me, what had been a big influence to me creatively in that format was Dave McKean had done an adaptation of, had done an updated version of Black Orchid. And I believe that was with Grant Morrison.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was really, I mean, everybody's kind of used to that now, but at the time, that was really groundbreaking.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Because again, it wasn't that it was just painted. It was also featuring, you know, like Lex Luthor was in it. I mean, you had mainstream DC characters being completely reinterpreted in this painterly style. So
painterly, you know, that's the whole point too. It wasn't just painted artwork. It was very expressive. It was very artsy fartsy, you know, and that was a big deal, as John said, you know.
Right. So, you know, the idea of doing something new in this format was really exciting. So Matt and I, you know, we would talk about it, and Matt had, you know, you were working on a ton of different things at that time too. So we kept talking about, you know, eventually we'll get around to something happening with this. And then it started picking up steam. We got it figured out that Dr. Midnight was going to be the character. You know, Archie had joined in on all this.
We also found out nobody had their hooks into Dr. Midnight yet. Everybody was like staking a claim to all these characters, you know.
Yeah.
It was like, well, nobody has Dr. Midnight yet. Done.
Yeah, it was really an interesting process. You know, because again, kind of described that period, there was a lot of openness, right? And, you know, if you wanted to do something new with a character, there was a lot of openness for that because the movie and TV thing had not exploded. So there wasn't all these, you know, licensing issues. And also on top of that, what I thought was great about Dr. Midnight was here's this really cool character who has a great look, but there's not a lot of background. You know, there's a lot you can do with him because there isn't like a huge body of continuity.
Yeah, there wasn't a huge legacy of story. Yeah,
right. So and by the way, for me visually, I had one of the things that I was inspired by to do Dr. Midnight was that Justice Society 1940s book I was talking about. There was an Alex Toth chapter in that story drew the Dr. Midnight segment. And it's got this great panel of Dr. Midnight, like with a capital in the background and the armies around him. And he's got one, you know, leg propped up and his cape's blowing. And that had stuck in my mind since I was a teenager, you know, so that was a big visual influence for me. But that was the beginning of strength of it.
John talking about the how open it was at DC at that point. And he's right in that the movie explosion hadn't happened yet. And, you know, once the movie explosion happened, everything started to become codified. They wanted to keep it like within their realm, you know. Until then, what they were noticing was the vast explosion of the indie comic scene and how these books were selling, and there was a lot of attention being paid to these creators. And specifically, Dick Giordano at DC was really tapped into that and really, you know, wanted DC to welcome these creators and their kind of different approach to things to reinvigorate things. And, you know, I mean, Archie Goodwin had an amazing history in comics and had been all over the field and had worked in mainstream and had worked for Warren for years. So many of the eerie and creepy stories that we love so much were written by Archie. So he too had a very open, welcoming editorial view to what we wanted to do, you know.
So when you guys were looking at this and getting the green light to go, right, and you're developing it, did you think of it as just a three-shot, you know, miniseries and that was going to be it? Or did you think of sequels, or did you think about the way they folded into DC continuity, or it was even going to be like a Vertigo, like you're saying, a Mystery Theater or something?
We never thought of it as Vertigo. It was going to be under DC. And I don't remember ever thinking about more. before, did we?
No, I don't. And I don't think Vertigo was around yet.
Yeah, it was. When we first started, I think it was.
Well, when it was published in 99, Vertigo started about 93. I actually worked in a comic shop from 91 to 96. Oh, okay. So I remember a lot of this stuff very well.
I didn't really have any plans past. As John said, I had my hands in so many other things, specifically my own characters. You know, when I went and worked with other characters, it was more like, all right, let me come in and you know, punch this character around a little bit and reshape it. And then I'm going to go off and, you know, somebody else can take what I did and do more with it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think that we were thinking of it as it was 150 painted pages. So
it was,
you know, we had the kind of an idea of a one, because I think I've always enjoyed drawing one big story arc. I've always kind of liked that with, like, when we did Grendel, it was like a 10 issue story arc, you know, when I did Fashion and Action, it was a specific story arc. I like the idea of doing one big enclosed story. So at the time, that's kind of how I envisioned it as well. You know, it was definitely open to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we assumed somebody was going to take it and do something more with it. You know, here you have this brand new version of the character. All right, DC, take it and run with it, you know.
Right.
Perfect timing with this being published in 1999 and the JSA series launching that was such a success, they folded him right in there. So he got a lot longer life than other reimagined characters did, that's for sure. So when you guys were working on the series, what did the actual workflow look like between you two? Was it full script? Was it something more collaborative? Was it plot first? How did you guys work together?
It was plot first. At that point in my career, I was only working plot.
Okay.
Plot and dialogue. I would provide a pretty complete plot. I would break it down by page, but not by panel. And occasionally I would throw in, you know, a very kind of like pertinent line of dialogue or, you know, a zinger or something like that. But at that point in my career, my attitude was, if I'm going to collaborate with another artist, I'm an artist too. If I want the ironclad control of a full script, kind of morally, I should draw it, right? So the only reason to collaborate with other artists was to enable them to bring a lot of their visual realities to the page, you know? And with John, I mean, John, you know, John had written and drawn his own stuff previously, so he already had a taste and a flavor for what it means to create something from the bottom up. And so John instilled a lot of his own ideas into and on top of my plot. And the way that works for your friends, for your viewers and listeners that don't know, is that, again, I write a plot, which is page one, this happens. Page two, this happens. And it's a pretty, it's not, you know, Dr. Midnight goes here, Dr. Midnight is here. It's more like a piece of prose, you know. You know, we open on a misty street and Dr. Midnight is doing this, blah, 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 blah. And then John would produce the artwork. Then it comes back to me. Then, you know, just seeing this artwork taken, these visuals taken to full fruition from what had been just descriptions by me, would suggest syntax, turns of phrases, etc. Then I lay down the narration and the dialogue on top of the artwork after it's been rendered. And again, traditionally this is known as Marvel style.
Right.
I tend to think I was writing a more complete plot than most Marvel artists were, certainly more than Stan was. for a long while, I found that very, very creatively invigorating. Nowadays, I write full scripts, and it's kind of the opposite. I pull back. I try and describe as least as I can to, again, afford the artist the most freedom he can have, you know?
Yeah, and I enjoyed working that way. I thoroughly enjoyed that, because Matt would set up enough of a framework or a foundation that, you know, I could figure out, you know, the dramatic highs and lows of balancing out each page, the settings, et cetera. And Matt and I were, you know, we were talking regularly. So it'd be like, hey, how about this? And hey, how about that? And let's have him go over here and let's add this to this panel. And, you know, so there's a lot of back and forth. But again, there was enough information in what Matt and I had discussed, some of the aspects of what we were going to be doing with this story, the tone, the setting, the characters and such, that it fills itself in, you know. And I think that's kind of what I really enjoyed about collaborating with Matt on this, was that we were able to, you know, work with each other. And Matt was like, well, here's like the starting point. And then again, Matt has got a tendency, he will look at an artist's work and see what their strengths are and, you know, what direction they go in with, what, you know, with their style and their mood and that sort of thing. And he will work in that direction with his plotting. And I thought it worked out really, really well with Dr. Midnight. It just, you know, it was almost like limitless. It was almost like there's just so much cool stuff that we can do here. You know, so I really enjoyed working with Matt in that form of collaboration.
I mean, the book had such a distinctive look, you know, as compared to other mainstream. I mean, you talk about the format of the publishing format, but the look itself, each page had looked so different from what was other mainstream comics at the time. So how did you guys approach that tone, establishing that tone and direction, you know, whether it be in the plot or in the artistry? How did you find the tone for the book?
Well, from the plot, you know, I will say what you're describing there, that's all John. But at the same time, we you know, narratively, again, as I said, our most important factor was this guy is not a second-rate Batman. He's a doctor. We have to establish that from the beginning, and that's the way he behaves throughout. He's not battle-oriented. Anything he does is defensive. You know, those blackout bombs, he hides in the smoke. He hides in the darkness because he can see, you know. We established early on that they call him he's kind of a rogue doctor. He's been kind of excommunicated from the medical community, and he still operates as a doctor on the streets. And on the streets, the junkies and the hookers and the street people, they call him the Midnight Doctor because that's when he comes around. So our whole approach was, he's already this guy. The fact that he gets these superpowers and takes on this alternate identity, that's just a disguise for him able to do it better. He's already the Midnight Doctor. There's a scene at the end of the first chapter where he's suiting up for the first time, and there's two panels that John drew where, you know, he's kind of in silhouette and then he pulls on his hood for the first time and there's visually no change. It's like, it's the same dude, right? It's like, there he is. Just, you know, got a different set of clothes on tonight, you know? Right. So that was our big deal, you know, to really, really make sure that he stayed a doctor. But then, as you're saying there, the look of it, how it looked visually, that's all John's expertise in artistry and mastery, you know.
Thanks. I you know, just you're saying how it didn't look like, again, getting back to what I was mentioning about the Black Orchid book by Dave McKean, also getting back to that period, because you had, not only did Dave do Black Orchid, but he also did New Arkham Asylum book. And also around that same time period, the painted books were going in a lot of different directions, interpreting classic, you know, DC characters. George Pratt's Enemy Ace book was a huge influence on me. I thought his style in that was incredible, beautifully painted book, and a completely different approach to, you know, somebody like Hubert, where it was, you know, it almost looked like it was painted in during World War One. You know, this kind of expressionist painting of war. And but then also you had like Bill Sienkiewicz was doing, you know, he had done Electra Assassin, which, yep, again was part of that period, like Dark Knight and Watchmen, where it was, you know, revolutionary in terms of the storytelling style.
Yeah, and the fact that two of the biggest creators at the time, Frank and Bill, chose to do Electra Assassin looking like that was just like, holy shit.
Yeah,
and it's really extraordinary, you know. They didn't care what people thought of it. They were like, we're doing this, you know.
Right, and they broke a lot of ground to make it like it's okay to take these traditional characters and reinterpret them visually. So, you know, I went full running with that kind of attitude with the visual look of it. And my thought was, and you also had Glenn Fabry was doing some great stuff.
Sure.
Bisley, the Judge Dredd Batman book, a huge input, just all these wild new ways of page layouts, painting techniques, you know, illustration techniques. I just thought it was, you know, very inspirational to me. And that was kind of the direction and influence that I had going in. But my thought about this storyline was, as Matt said, this character was, you know, he was the Midnight Doctor, but he was a good guy. Like, he's a good guy. He's not twisted. He's not like, there was a lot of emphasis to make characters who are traditionally heroic much darker during this period. Dr. Midnight looks dark, but my attitude was, and Matt and I had discussed this when we were working on it, was the look of the book would be kind of ominous and sinister because it's a rundown town and it's being overrun with corruption by the terrible trio, these industrialists. And you know, the town's, you know, disease and you know, all these social issues. And but Dr. Midnight himself would actually be a heroic character,
a fairly pure character too. His motivations, he doesn't have this overwhelming angst motivating him. It's more that he's truly a doctor. His father was a Nobel Prize winning doctor. He's, you know, his attitude is like, this is what you do in life. You help people, you know. Right. He's not there to punish crime. He's there to help people. So John's talking about these ominous scenes and all that incredible mist he's drawing and everything. And Midnight shows up like, here's some aspirin. You
know? Yeah. And if you go back and look at it, you'll see that it's kind of like it. And so that was my approach to it. My other influence, and again, this was a big thing that Matt and I had talked about too, was we really wanted to do kind of a modern day pulp character, you know, like the Shadow, like, and he's kind of a combination of the Shadow and Doc Savage too, mm-hmm. you know, or Doc Savage. In fact, he's got the Widow's Peak. That was an actual nod to Doc Savage.
Oh, and
there's a panel in the book where he's holding up a vial when we first meet him in his lab. And I patterned it specifically after an old, you know, 1930s.
Doc Savage classic cover. Right. Yeah. Yeah. One of the best, in fact. Yeah. Because it establishes him as being a man of science, not this ripped shirt, you know, flexing muscle guy. It's like, oh, what's in this vial? You know?
So, you know, again, because there was a whole new period of how, you know, I was used to doing line art and, you know, using blue lines and all that. The idea that you could just do full color on the page and, you know, the watercolor, pencil, paint, the whole concept of the series just played really well into just going wild visually.
And dude, you can't underestimate the effect that producing Jekyll and Hyde had. You know, that was your warm up for this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
That was his first really full painted project. And if you go and look at Jekyll and Hyde, you get to see all the seeds of what he later brings to full fruition. And Dr. Midnight, you know.
And, you know, Archie was, you know, kind of guiding me along the way too, and especially in the initial, when I was initially starting out, you know, but he was always encouraging, you know, just to go in the direction I wanted to go to visually. And I just felt like working with Archie, it just made you better, you know. Mm-hmm. I was just really, he was really a great inspiration to work with.
I think that's a through line every time someone mentions Archie. It's just what an amazing inspiration he was.
Yeah, no shit. Yeah. Yeah.
So you just mentioned, I mean, obviously this book, you've got so many different things going in here. For you, John, like, you know, you mentioned the inks, the pencils, the paints, all the textures. Like, how long did it take you to do one page? Because they're so complex.
A really long time.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, that was the downside of the project. It took a long time to produce.
It took a long time. So, you know, it was, again, some pages went faster than others. Sometimes, you know, I was trying something really new and, you know, I would rework something. And it's funny because I was just starting to work with, on this project, I worked with Strathmore Illustration Board, which at that time was this beautifully, it's still okay, but the quality of this paper is nothing now what it used to be like. It used to have this certain resistance where you could just pummel the page. I mean, you could draw and then you could watercolor, and then you could paint, and then you could take the X-Acto knife and, you know, make scratching. And if you didn't like it, you could take the electric eraser, and it, you know.
It was hardy shit.
it was really, really durable. So a lot of times my process would be is, and I still do this to this day, is I would do a tight pencil drawing. And then I would use spray fixative to hold the pencil drawing, and then I could work the color over the top. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because what would happen is sometimes I would have, it didn't happen all the time, but it did happen more than once. And that was to get something to where I really liked it, and then I didn't like it, and I could literally take the color off with, you know, water and even like a little bit of sandpaper, and the pencil drawing would be there, and I would start over. Mm. So that ended up, that didn't happen often.
Bad opportunity.
So, you know, the thing is that I was really fortunate in that there was, they let me work on it as long as it took for it to get done. And, you know, that was really a break, because it allowed me to get it to the point where, you know, it looked like it did. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that. But, But it did get very involved, for sure, to say the least.
Well, all the time and effort was well worth it. It's one of the most gorgeous books I've seen.
I mean, that's the thing, you know, looking back on that. I mean, it's been, like you said, it's been 27 years since it came out now. And, you know, I'm happy to see it. You know, it's nice. It's like, it's okay. The time spent on it, it feels good now. Especially, I also like the fact that, you know, that character, that version of Dr. Midnight is still actively being used to this day.
That's amazing. And they've also, they followed what you said, Matt. They make sure to focus that he's a doctor first. You hear that all the time, especially when he first came in the JSA. I remember there's a great line with Black Canary. He's like, wait, you're actually a doctor and you call yourself doctor? It was great.
John and I have talked about this. We've seen certain cover images and stuff where he's, you know, he's holding some crescent moon darts like Batman's, you know, and that looks a little too, that's kind of missing the point.
But a lot of people have done a pretty nice job on him overall, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I've got a question. Now, by the way, a lot of these questions were sourced from a lot of fans of the book or of your work and of listening to the show. One of these questions comes from an actual medical doctor who has a question for both of you, which is the medical aspects, obviously, of Dr. Midnight are central to the character, as we talked about. How did you approach making those elements feel so authentic, both in the writing and visually?
No, again, I wish we would have had the internet. I tried to do as best as I could, but, you know, if any doctor says it's close enough for jazz, I'll take it.
Wow. So that was just you. That was just you doing it. Yeah, okay. What about you, John? Did you use references or anything? Or
well, you know, it's funny because, again, my approach to this project was, you know, it was no matter how fantastic it looked in terms of the stylistic approach and you know, kind of the graphic interpretation and such, I tried to make it feel as real as possible. Like, again, one of my influences during that period was you know, outside of comics was, you know, that was when James Cameron was doing, he did Terminator 2 specifically. And that to me was just like a cornerstone in like just fantasy making style, you know, the use of the smoke and the color and all that. But Cameron, I thought, had a really great sense of making the unreal seem as real as possible. You know, he brought this real intensity to it. And I think I read some interviews where he might have said something like that, but I saw it in the work too, and in True Lies as well, you know. So I felt like, I guess, you know, when Matt would come up with the, like, whatever kind of medical solution that Midnight was getting out of, you know, I would just kind of try to apply that sense of intensity, even if it, and like you said, you know, just, you know, just through mood, I guess is the best way to put it. So, but anyway, that's great to hear.
Yeah.
But I really think so. Yeah.
So, we talked about Dr. Midnight being a recreation and all that. So how did you approach creating this new Dr. Midnight and still keep some kind of connection to what came before? So as far as developing the character himself, how did you feel like the story wise connecting him? And then artistically, how did you feel like you would hold on to what had come before and design something new?
We never really addressed the fact that Charles Midnighter existed in this universe. And I just kind of always assumed that, you know, Peter, whatever, had, of course, had heard of this character. And when he experienced a similar accident and similar powers, reactions, whatever you want to call it, seeing in the dark, just adopted this identity as a matter of course. But again, we established at the beginning that he was already this character. He was already called the Midnight Doctor. He did all this stuff previously just without a costume, you know. And then John, you can go ahead and talk about, you know, it was John's influence so far as redesigning the costume to have a more kind of 80s, 90s tactical look rather than the 40s tunic and spandex, you know.
Well, as far as the look of him, his costume and such, it was, I felt like, and I think, again, we would talk about this all the time, I think the thought was to retain the classic look of Dr. Midnight, you know, because I just felt like there was no reason to do a complete overhaul of the costume to where it was unidentifiable from the original Golden Age look. But at the same time, I wanted to get away from, frankly, the bright green cape, you know, because it didn't really, I mean, again, it's
not good for hiding in the shadows.
Yeah, exactly. And it really didn't fit into, you know, what we were talking about, the mood and such. And I felt as a doctor, Dr. midnight, it would be more like blues and purples and that sort of thing. And also that the character would develop, like this is his beginning. So in the first issue, at the last page of the first issue, when his first costume is revealed, you know, it's a variation of the original costume, but it's in, again, it's in blues and purples. And, you know, he doesn't have the, he's got long boots. They're not like the Buccaneer boots that the Golden Age character had. And he's got a very similar look. But then by the time we got to the third issue, and he's become more refined in his character, and he's getting ready to go to battle, you know, with the terrible trio, the Fox, the Shark, and the Vulture, and all their resources and their steroid army guys and all that sort of thing. He gets on this kind of battle armor, which became, which was, again, a slight redesign of the original costume, but it was more a battle armor style that they have used basically modifications of since in the later renditions of them. And the influence for that for me at the time in coming up with that final design was Blade had just come out when I was working on the third issue. And again, getting back to, again, yet another cycle of the superhero movie scene, the Batman back in 89, that started one, I think, cycle. But I really believe Blade was kind of the beginning of the Marvel cycle. And
sure
and
was, yeah.
I
yep.
feel like...
It deserves more credit than it gets. Yeah, yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that costume design was fantastic. And I think that it's been very... I think that initial design of that character has... You've seen it. You can see it to this day. And a lot of the other costume designs.
It's even more influential than the Bob Ringwood Batman.
Yeah, I think the Ringwood design and the early Batman designs definitely are the predecessors to that. But there was a certain look to that I thought was really cool. And
it was more functional in Blade.
And then I brought back the traditional color of the red tunic. And that sort of thing. And I actually, that initial design, he goes underwater in that last issue. So I had it so the mask had a removable part, you know, in the front part too. So it would be kind of like a oxygen mask.
Let me just say, we did that whole sequence because John is such a giant fan of the James Bond film Thunderball.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, this feels so Thunderball.
It is so Thunderball. Yep. Yeah, very deliberately so. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact,
I just watched Thunderball recently. That sequence holds up so well, that underwater battle sequence. It's so epic.
Well, we have the oil rig in there too. That's kind of a nod to Diamonds Are Forever. So
yep.
So we've mentioned the Terrible Trio a couple times now. I gotta ask, I mean, it's such a weird, distinctive group. Like, I'm assuming, Matt, did you pick them? And was it just flipping through who's who and just went,
I think we kind of picked them together. We were kind of tossing around for, you know, who. And of course, they were originally Batman villains, is that right?
Yeah.
But what we liked about them was they were all in business suits originally, you know? So it was like, okay, we're gonna make these corporate assholes, you know? And, you know, I have to say, it's kind of depressing that the villains of then are still the villains now, you know? It's like, what? Why has society not moved on past this yet? You know, but you know, the whole approach to them having these weird Masonic rituals, you know, and wearing these masks as totems, you know, was really, I think, instrumental into making them kind of different than their Batman villain versions. That first scene where we see them for the first time, and it's kind of like they're all looking over their shoulders. One of them's holding like a sextant, and one of them's holding a, you know, a pentagram thing. And oh my God, they just look so demonic in every fashion, you know.
You guys definitely made them your own. You made them your characters without a doubt, certainly.
Well, we were, you know, and again, it was one of those things where they were characters where it was like, hey, can we use the Terrible Trio? And it's like, they did not have a big background. They had not been used a lot. So it was
the response was, why would you want to?
But I think part of it is too, is because Matt, you know, came up with the idea of the naming the bad guy, you know, their corporation, Preda, you know, Predator. And I think that was the whole aspect of it, was this, that there was along with the medical theme, I think we had kind of an environmental theme too, like, because, you know, Dr. Midnight, his headquarters was in the woods. He's got the owl, you know, these were predatorial creatures, you know, they're very anti environmental, actually. And I think that was kind of an underlying visual vibe. You know, you've got the owl, you've got the shark, fox, the vulture.
And the vulture's a scavenger. So the vulture's yeah. even like one step removed. Like the other two take down and kill, and he just eats what's left, you know?
Right.
So we got to talk about all the operatives that Dr. Midnight was working with, even before he was Dr. Midnight, when he was the Midnight Doctor, right? I mean, people like Icicle and Nightlight and Mouthpiece and even Camilla Marlowe. So each one of them have a very strong presence. They're very defined. They feel like they're part of the city. What kind of inspirations? I mean, you mentioned the pulp stuff. I mean, I don't know if the Shadow was an influence because of the operatives.
The Shadow is the influence. Shadow is the influence. When you read the pulp novels, which I was a huge fan of and very well versed in at that point, the Shadow cannot operate without his crew of operatives. He's not just a singular singular force like Batman. Batman ultimately, you know, assembles a family of other costumed characters. The Shadow has all these people in the field that work for him that are basically civilians or look like civilians and operate as civilians. And that was our approach. But at the same time, it was a different world than the Shadow's world. The Shadow had, you know, a couple guys in the underground, a couple guys here, a couple guys in the financial district. He had one black guy and one female Asian operative. And for the 30s and 40s, that was pretty advanced, you know. But ours was like, all right, if he's going to have this crew, it has to be of and on the streets. It has to be the world he's operating in. And so, yeah, we just set about coming up with this crew of characters that were all people that were outside the system and were, you know, kind of the downtrodden, the cast aside, which doesn't preclude their skills, their intelligence, their beneficial nature to what he's trying to do.
And also, Doc Savage also had a group of operatives as
well.
Yes,
that too. Yep.
So,
yep.
And so
Doc's was like an inner crew. You know, it wasn't as dispersed as the Shadows and as Doc Midnight's.
And a little more, and again, a much more the Shadow.
All white dudes too, by the way.
That's right. So this was like the exact, and this was very much very different in that respect. But the whole process of it was like kind of his street crew. And with Camilla Marlowe, it was, you know, it was good to have, I think, a strong female character that was, you know, Dr. Midnight's kind of an enigma and a mystery, and she is a professional mystery writer. And, you know, through, you know, the reader kind of follows her lead into learning more about him through her, but she's a bit of an enigma herself, you know, so they're kind of a perfect duo that way.
And she's his patient.
Right. And she's his patient. Right.
And she lives in the darkness like he does.
Right. Yeah. So I thought, you know, we both thought that was a great combination as well. So,
well, they're all interesting characters, and Camilla was a great way to get into the story. So you're not always in Peter's head. Peter's head. Forget it. I can't get it.
Just anyway. Call him Peter. Just do it.
All right. Dr. Cross. Dr. Cross's head. Yes, yeah. Camilla gives you the view of it, which was a great way to tell that story.
And in fact, anytime in the years since I've worked with I've finally had a chance to work on The Shadow, I usually make Margot Lane the narrator.
Okay.
To give us that same kind of outsider and female view of what this character is doing, you know.
So the characters really are, they do feel very much of the city, and specifically it was Portsmouth, right? So I got to ask, now there's a lot of Portsmouths around the country, but was this supposed to be a real location? Or is this going to be more like the fictional cities? And, you know, is this going to be the new metropolis? Is this going to be a new Gotham? Is this going to be a fictional city? And how did that decision shape the way you guys developed the city visually and what was going on in it?
Well, I live in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
So it's basically Portland, although I imagine it more of an East Coasty Portland. And very early in the process, John had come out to... John, why were you here? Why were you visiting out here that time?
I'm trying to remember.
Was it? Did we do that? We did a Grendel Day up in Seattle.
Grendel Day up in Seattle.
Yeah. So he got to see Portland, and I live kind of right near the river where there's a, now it's completely abandoned, giant paper mill. Mm. So this kind of rotting industrial, you know, just like, bleh, you know, pile of shit. And I remember we drove over there one day, and, you know, we got off at this viewpoint, and John was just like, oh, I need some pictures of this, you know?
That's true. Yeah. And I know. So yeah, I took elements of that. And then also I had just recently moved back into the Washington, D.C. area. And they were doing a lot of, it seemed like a big deal at the time. It's nothing like what's happened in the last 10 years in that area. But there was all this major gentrification going on. And what was indicative of that was you always know when something's going down when you start seeing cranes pop up. And it was just this like sea of cranes.
And there's cranes everywhere.
Yeah. And again, visually, okay, that could be a
that
good
means they're building on top of something else.
Right.
Somebody else's life.
Right. And so to me, getting back to that whole visual aspect of the book and the Preda and predatorial and all that, the cranes to me were like getting back to the vultures. You know, if you so there are some shots in the book I probably would have put in more, you know, going back if I could make it more obvious. But at the time, you know, I would try to put in as much cranes in the background, especially in the first issue, you know, just to give that kind of hint. But that was part of my inspiration. And again, combining the look of Portland. But I was also looking at, and I can't quite remember exactly what cities I was looking at, but some of the shanty towns.
Detroit, probably, for sure.
Some other countries as well, major cities, and kind of combining all these elements to create this, you know, it's like it was almost like a giant political cartoon, you know, to the way the city would look. And I, you know, this is kind of going back to some of what we were doing when we were working together on Grenville too, you know, getting a little bit of commentary in visually.
I can totally see that. Absolutely. So looking back big picture wise, is there a particular scene or sequence or moment in the series that really stands out to each of you individually and that really captures what the series is all about? Is there a moment or a scene or a sequence that you just go, that's Dr. Midnight. That's what it is. Why don't we
John,
start
I'll let you go first.
Oh my gosh. I don't know. That's tough because there's a couple. I mean, I kind of felt like I was trying to do that on every page.
yeah. No shit. Yeah.
You know, but you know, it's funny because I look back on it and I was, you know, kind of reviewing it before we had our talk today. And, you know, it's funny. You think you remember everything and some of the stuff I've forgotten, and it's kind of pleasant to look back on, but there's so many different aspects of it. But so things will look different to me each time, you know? And again, that one page I was telling you about where you first see Dr. Midnight in his lab and it's the Doc Savage pose. I'm still real happy with how that came out. There's a sequence where he first comes on to the big lair that the fox, the shark, and the vulture have, and it was a double page spread, and he's
that's a killer, man.
Background and that, and I really was happy with how that came out. As far as an intimate level, I really liked this one sequence where, again, in the first issue, where Dr. Midnight is first trying to gain the trust of the Camilla Marlowe character, and he's kind of kneeling down to, you know, offer his hand to her, and she's sitting looking away from him, and there's an inset of hands and his hand held out, and she eventually takes his hand in the third panel. And I still really like that page when I look back on it, as far as like the, you know, the personal relationship, you know, this kind of platonic sense of trust the two characters have between each other. But, you know, just on a pure theatrical level, I, you know, there's a lot of fun stuff in there where the character gets to do his thing as Dr. Midnight. So I'll let Matt fill in, you know, what he
well,
likes.
Well, yeah, all that shit he said is great. The one scene I mentioned earlier that I still just love is, and they are just two kind of horizontal panels in the middle of a page where he's suiting up for the first time and he's the same guy, you know. it really stresses that, you know, this what has happened to this guy was just a catalyst. Nothing has changed. He is still on this mission. He is still a doctor. He is still absolutely concerned with healing and helping people. And then I think it's in the third volume, there's a sequence where there's a a mother and her kids, and
That's yeah. The second issue.
Yeah, second issue. Yeah.
Second issue. So there's a bunch of deep shit going down, and he still takes time to, like, you know, address this mother and her kids, and, you know, like, she's buying them junk food and stuff. And when you watch a show like The Pit, which is just absolute adrenaline, you know, blah, 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 these doctors still, at the drop of a hat, will take what they're doing and turn to a new case that needs their attention, boom, without a question, you know, and that to me really stressed the doctor-ness of the character over and over and over again. And then, of course, the very last page where he's standing and he's got his owl and the caption is "The doctor is in."
Yeah.
You know, just like, come on, man. That's everything we were aiming for from the very beginning. it's the perfect image. It's the perfect abbreviated caption. Boom. Yep. There we go. We got him. That's our version of the character.
Stunning.
Yeah,
page.
I remember when I was working on that last, and it was the last page, you know, it was like, wow, I'm really going to, you know, it's really happening. It's
I'm almost done.
And it's funny, if you go back and look at that page, you know, he's standing on a rock and the water's crashing against the rock and he's holding the owl out, you know, and you know, if you look at it, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, this is happening, this is, the doctor is in. And I put that the rendering of his hand with the arched arm with the owl perched on it, you know, that fist, it was done with great relish.
That visually was just unbelievable. Page, it was absolutely gorgeous. When I wrote these questions, I felt like I needed to answer this question myself too. So I picked, actually, over last week, you said, Matt, those last three or four pages of issue one, where it visually it's amazing, but also he opens up to Camilla for the first time.
Yeah,
really,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And tells her, like, what his, sort of, it's his mission statement, basically. Yep. He's talking about, you know, gonna help.
Yep.
And then he suits up, and as he said, puts on the cowl, and you get that last shot. Another huge, just kapow moment, that last page where he's in the costume for the first time, and you see him, as you said, in all the purples and the blues, and it's gorgeous, and he's got the owl. Just that was my pick. But every single one you guys mentioned is like, oh yeah, that one too. That's amazing. All of them are. Like you said, John, you put it all on every page. It was amazing.
Let me share a little owl info, because I live in Oregon and I've been to various outdoor schools with my kids over the years. This is something a lot of people don't know. Owls cannot move their eyes in their eye sockets. Their eyes are so gigantic that to have the muscle structure around their eyes to move their eyes like we do, their head would be the size of a pumpkin. That's why they can do this. They can turn their head all the way freaking around. If you ever see an owl, their eyes never move. They are doing this constantly.
That is fascinating. I had no, who knew I was going to learn something on this?
Here's owl fact number two. We were at the same outdoor school, and they had a bunch of displays of natural stuff. And we were on the last day, and they brought out a hawk, a dried hawk wing, and a dried owl wing. And owls, the feathers on their wings are dispersed, so they're not sharp like on a hawk, right? They're dispersed. They have a lot of fuzziness along the edge to disperse the air, right? So the ranger took the hawk wing and went like that through the air, and it went tip, 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 tip. Took the owl wing and did that, made no sound at all. They're the silent predators. They fly through the night. I mean, he shook that thing like hard, and it didn't make a sound.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, they're terrifying.
They are fascinating creatures. Fascinating.
Absolutely. They're great to draw.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Very dramatic. Yeah.
And you crush those scenes, too. Oh, man. So I honestly, I could talk about this miniseries for hours more, but I want to be respectful of y'all's time. And now, gentlemen, it is time for you to face the lightning round. All right? I'm going to give you five.
Ready, John?
Brace yourselves.
Bring it on.
I'm going to give you 5 seconds to answer each question. All right. So this one's for both of you. We'll start with Matt. What action figures or statues are on display in your studio right now?
Oh, my stuff.
For the people listening and not watching, maybe expand upon that a little bit.
So, Grendel, I don't really collect action figures. I only have my stuff. Grendel stuff, here, I'll show you the...
Don't break anything.
Oh, no. The Trinity action figures I designed. Oh,
nice.
But if you can see back there, over the years, I have a million Grendel statues, action figures, stuff like that. So that's my self-aggrandized, self-serving display. I will say I only have this stuff down in my studio. I only display my own art in my studio.
Okay.
I don't display it up in our house. My studio is at home. It's a daylight basement. If it was on display where I'm not working, it would just bug the shit out of me because I would only focus on what I don't like about it.
Oh, okay.
I would only be like, all right, that part's wrong, you know? Whereas down here, it's a process. So okay. I can adapt, I can accept it as part of the process, where if I had it on display upstairs, couldn't take it.
That's fascinating. A very interesting insight and great job keeping that answer to 5 seconds.
it wasn't quite five. But okay.
John, what about you?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I actually happen to have the Dr. Midnight action
figure. There you go, man.
It's on the one that I designed for the series.
That's gorgeous.
And I actually don't have a lot of action figures around here, but it's nice to have this one for sure.
John, I got to ask, did they send you that or did you have to buy it?
Oh, I got it myself.
Are we really surprised, though?
Yeah, I'm so surprised. That's why I asked.
All right, John, this question is just for you. Who would win in a fight? Francis Knight from Fashion and Action or Amanda Waller from The Suicide Squad?
What, fighting each other?
Yeah.
Oh, no, they would team up and fight crime together.
That's not wrong.
I like that. I like that. All right, Matt, for you, if Hunter Rose from Grendel, or really any other Grendels, because, I mean, there's a few you could choose from, somehow ended up as one of Dr. Midnight's patients, how long do you think that doctor's visit would last before things went completely off the rails?
Depends on how he served them as a doctor.
Well, you're the
Hunter
writer.
Anyway, if they came to blows, that's the end of Dr. Midnight. again, Batman barely held his own against Hunter Rose.
Oh, that was a gorgeous book. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so question for both of you. We'll start with John. Of all the comics in your collection that you were not involved in creating, which do you personally treasure the most?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. pure sentimental value. It's recently come up is my Aunt Betty, when I was a kid, bought me a copy of the Jimmy Olsen issue with Don Rickles.
It was part of
Kirby's Fourth World series. He had just started
kind of the precursor of that.
Yeah, and it was I was getting ready to take a bus trip on my own. I was about 10. It was kind of a big deal, and we were at the bus depot, and she bought me wanted a comic to read on the bus, and she got me that, and it was 25 cents because they had a Golden Age reprint in the back. So not only did you have this, this was my
crazy
first,
as shit story.
because it was my introduction to the whole Fourth World thing with the Boom Tomb and the and I was not familiar with any of that yet.
None of us were. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah,
but it was totally fascinating. And but anyway, there was that, and it was just the most bizarre comic. But then in the back was the first Newsboy Legion Guardian by Jack Kirby, and I guess it's Joe Simon. And I was familiar with Kirby's work, but I was not familiar with his Golden Age work. That was the first time I had seen this style as people, some I've heard described as, people wrapped in cellophane, everybody's shiny, right? But the amount of detail in every single panel, and the story, because it was like, these street kids, again, getting back to this kind of urban theme, street kids, and the Guardian is, he's a cop, but, he's the Guardian at night, and he's helping the kids out. And the fact that it was Kirby, like in the present day, and then the Kirby, the younger Kirby, and he had these two completely different styles. And, this one is kind of an urban setting. The other is this crazy science fiction setting. Plus, he was using photo collage
crazy photo collage that he did, which is
and in the middle there's in the middle there was a page where it's Kirby at his drawing table, a self-portrait he did. And he's at his drawing table and he's like, hey, welcome to, my comic. And boy, here's some of my older work. But in the background of his studio, there's like a mountain. There's a bunch of mountains. And I thought, what a great life this guy's got. You know,
like, he's living in Germany. He's
got mountains. He draws outer. He uses clock, photo clock. I mean, so the whole. I read this. It was a 3 or 4 bus ride trip. I read this thing cover to cover, all the way back and forth, and. You know, I still have it. It's all beat up and stuff, but I still have it. But I think I treasure it the most because looking back on it, it showed me the range that you could have, that you could be in the field for decades and you could have all these different styles. And I think that it was, I didn't really see it at the time, but I look at it now and I think it was a source of great inspiration to me, you know? And coming from my aunt, I always felt like, you know, that kind of gave it a big sentimental vibe too. So I think that one right now is in the top spot.
Wow. The great story. And once again, great job keeping it to 5 seconds. I'm impressed.
Yeah, dude, no, it's not going to be 5 seconds. So let's just toss that shit out the window right now.
I am messing with you. I am absolutely messing with you. All right, Matt. So what about you?
So this is stuff that I had when I was personally younger.
Or whatever. Any comic in your collection now or when you were a kid.
I could go on and on and on with stuff that I've rediscovered later. But I'm going to have to go with Kubert's run on Tarzan.
Ooh, okay.
I think I was a big fan of the Tarzan books. I read them all when I was a very young teen. When DC got the license, that had a huge effect on me. And I really accredit Kubert's work on that with teaching me how to tell a story.
Wow.
Teaching me how to take a lot of information and distill it into the pertinent moments that you need, how to know when to draw the whole jungle, how when to know not to draw the jungle at all. And the visceral quality of his art, and that's just a magnificent. I don't have those anymore in their original form. I have the Dark Horse Gallery Edition. But again, can't rave enough about what an effect that work had on me.
Joe Kubert taught a lot of people how to draw. So yep, absolutely. Yep.
And again, not how to draw, how to tell a story.
Sorry. Good point. Yeah, good point. Yep. Good distinction.
Good point. For sure.
So John, all right. This is a very deeply serious question. So I want you to treat it with the dignity it deserves. Which is your favorite space monkey? Gleek from the Super Friends or Blip from Space Ghost?
Well, Blip's my time frame. That's my period. Yeah, the other fellow was a little later down the road. So it's got to be Blip.
There we go.
You know.
Absolutely. So, Matt, here's your question.
Here's a 5 second one for you.
There you go. Now, Matt, you obviously pointed out your connection to the Trinity from DC. So, in the 1980s, did you ever eat Superman peanut butter or the Batman Batman breakfast cereal?
No, I was probably too poor to afford those at that point. Truthfully, I didn't even know they had those. Seriously, they had Batman breakfast? Oh, but, no, I remember those. They were shaped like little golden bats, weren't
yes,
they?
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. So
what were the Superman peanut butter? It was just they had the label?
It was like Jif or something, or Jiffy, yeah, I think it was. No, and it was around 1981, everything. And they just decided to brand Superman on that. Yeah, and then, the Batman cereal was absolutely to do with the movie. So, yeah.
Yeah. Nope, never had either of them.
Well, if you remember the shape of them, I'm wondering if maybe you did. But anyway.
I saw an ad. Yeah. Yep.
All right, this one's for both of you. We'll start with Matt. If you had to start an entirely new career today, what would you do?
Well, John knows the answer to this one. I would be a chef. I am a gourmet cook. I am very renowned amongst my immediate circle. I always tell people if I hadn't learned to draw first, I would have been a chef. And thank God I learned to draw first, because being a cook is a thankless, hardcore, terrible job that, you know, when we watch Food Network and stuff like that, and we see all these celebrity chefs, everybody's kind of imagines, oh, I'm going to be that star. No, that is the far less than 1%.
Right.
And I had a friend, a colleague of mine, another comic book artist who was married to a sous chef, and just a hard life. You're on your feet all the time. You have back and ankle problems and knee problems. You get off at 1 a.m. and then you just come home and want to drink for a couple hours before you pass out and get up and start it all over again. I love cooking. I do not want that to be my profession ever.
So what we need is at one of these comic conventions, someone needs to host a panel on like Iron Chef and like you and some other comic creators that like to cook.
Maybe somebody has tried many times.
Okay.
That's not why I'm in it.
Fair enough.
Although, let me backtrack here just a very brief bit. A number of years ago, my sister-in-law, former editor Diana Schutz, when she had an imprint at Marvel, at Dark Horse called Maverick, mm-hmm. she did a book called Autobiographics. where she asked people to do an autobiographical comic, right? Which were, you know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of autobiographical cartoonists, but she was asking this of people who don't normally do autobiographical comics. So Frank Miller did a thing about being on the set of the first Daredevil movie, the Ben Affleck one, you know? Will Eisner did one about being in an art director's office in the 40s and meeting one of his favorite children's book illustrators.
Oh.
And I said to her, well, Di, you know, I mean, Mage is my autobiography. That's what I do. You know, it's, you know, she's like, but I definitely want you in this collection. So I did a recipe and it was called Comic Book Chef. Right. And I showed you how to make chicken Parmesan because I didn't want to scare people off. Right. Didn't want to get too complicated, but number of years I've had people tell me, oh yeah, I've made your chicken Parmesan. But one time I was signing at a convention and I had a line of people, probably 10-20 people long, and some dude comes by and he's not really looking to get the signature, but he just leans over and knocks on my table and goes, dude, your chicken Parmesan, good for the love life. Like, I think that's the best review I've ever gotten.
You're helping comic nerds in the romance department, which is exactly
what I would have been a chef. I'm so glad I'm not.
John, what about you? If you had to start a new career right now, what would you do?
Oh, man, I'll tell you, it's a tough one because it just, this is so, there's been so singular, you know, since.
Yeah, there's just no, there's no other,
but
you just don't have many other thoughts in our head, truthfully.
Yeah, but, you know, when Matt brought up astronaut, same thing. When I was a kid, that was a big thing. But I tell you, when I was a little kid, Dick Tracy was my first really favorite character. I just thought, you know, the comic strip, you know, you'd still get the Sunday paper. He was like the lead feature on the Sunday paper when I was a kid. And he had the little Crime Stoppers notebook handle up in the upper right-hand corner. Anyway, I thought I wanted to be a police sketch artist.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I always thought that would be really cool to do. And I always loved the scenes in the old TV shows, the cop shows, the Untouchables, or the crime shows, and the guy would do the police, you know, he looks a little like this and looks a little like that. And I always thought that would be a really fascinating that.
And eventually you would draw Kaiser Soze.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. And, you know, and that and courtroom sketch art. That whole realm to me is fascinating.
You know, whenever I look at those courtroom sketches, they are cartoons. They are exactly. Very expressive cartoons. Yeah.
Yeah. And I always thought so either, but now that, you know, the whole thing with the police sketch art, again, I thought about it when I was a kid, which was just straight, you know, pencil paper. Now it's so much more sophisticated, done digitally and such. It's a far more advanced field now. But that basic thought of it as a kid, that always enticed me. So
that's really cool.
That's pretty far flung, you know.
You would have been amazing at it. So all right, so last question, and we'll start with you, John, and then go to Matt. What is the most unusual thing you've been asked to autograph?
Man, I got to think about that. I'm trying to think. Nothing particularly. No, I'm sure. I can't quite remember. You know, because nothing really particularly unusual. I know it's some kind of motorcycle helmet or skateboard. You know, really, really nothing. I know there's been something amazing. And I can remember somebody asked me to do something for them that was really personal. It was and I'm sorry, I can't remember it right now.
That's okay. I would say it was these Dr. Midnights you signed for me, but that's not very exciting. That's not very exciting.
Where was that? Where'd you get him to sign those?
That was Baltimore Comic Con last year. I've met John a couple times now, though.
I remember. Okay. Yep. And, but you know, I can't really give you a real zinger right now, except that, you know, people bring all sorts of things for you to sign, you know.
Right.
And I can remember, I do enjoy when somebody will bring like something like Captain America's shield or something. There's just a gazillion sketches on it. And, you know, sometimes they'll do it for somebody that's not, you know, that's not doing well, and it's to cheer them up or something like that. All that kind of stuff is always really neat to do too.
Yeah.
Your turn, Matt.
I had this couple that used to come see me all the time in San Diego when I was going there regularly. I haven't been for many years now, again, because it just turned into this something that I don't recognize anymore at San Diego. But they were huge Grendel fans. And in fact, they had twin sons and they named them Hunter and Orion. And thank God those are not weird names. those are actually okay names. Yeah. But the guy came in one day and on his deltoid. He had the Grendel eyes tattooed. He's like, dude, do your signature. So I put my M. Wagner signature, and he came back the next day with it tatted.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. That is amazing.
Yep.
So now he can go to the bank and forge your signature.
There you go. That's not my legal signature. That's my art signature. Ah. I have two separate ones.
smart man. Yeah. So gentlemen, this has been amazing, but I want you to tell the folks at home what projects you're currently working on, where they can find you online, and how they can support your work nowadays, today. Well, John, why don't we start with you, and then we'll go to Matt.
Well, right now I'm working on the series I started out with, my creator-owned series, Fashion in Action, and I'm working on a new collection, and it's going to have a new storyline included with the reprint of the original series, and I'm actively working on actually the cover for that right now, and that will lead into I'm plotting out doing a whole new like 100-150 page story to follow up with that volume. So I'm working on all the beginning stages of that right now. Working on multiple covers, lots of commissions, and if anyone is interested in a commission or contacting me, that can reach me at johnksnyder.com, and I'm also available on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So that's just a little bit of what I got going on right now.
And you folks should be following him anyway, because he posts amazing artwork all the time. Yeah. And he's posted a whole bunch of Dr. Midnight sketches over the years I've seen too. So okay. Matt, what are you doing nowadays?
Oh, how long we got? So I would say the most immediate thing is the fact, two things. I'm working now on a current Grendel series. This is part of a four-part epic. Each part is four issues, and Dark Horse is releasing one part per year. So this summer will be the second four-part series, and there's two more following that. I'm writing and drawing that. It's a Grendel Prime series. Brings back a very favorite character, Christine Spar.
I heard she was dead.
Yeah, well, there's cloning in the future. But then I've also been working on, for the last several years, this big project with my dear friend and magnificent artist, Kelly Jones, a series of graphic novels about Dracula that we've done. We offer the exclusively through a Kickstarter campaign, the hardcover editions, but then Dark Horse Comics later releases it as a trade paperback version. We have three of those done, and the fourth one will, the Kickstarter campaign for the fourth one, which is the end of our initial story arc, will end, will premiere this, we do it in October, because Halloween, Dracula, you know. we have a Grendel game that just came out from Off the Page Games that was a big Kickstarter campaign, is now getting offered through regular game shops, game retail shops. And then there's an extremely popular podcast called Last Podcast on the Left, which is, again, extremely popular. They do a comic book via Z2. And in the fourth edition of that, I drew a story that's written by the main guy, Marcus Parks, that is the story of Sid and Nancy, of who killed Nancy Spungen. 20-page story written by Marcus, drawn by me, colored by my son Brennan, who's my frequent and regular collaborator. Okay, that's enough to mention for now.
I also wanted to mention, in addition to developing the new Fashion and Action series, that I did a graphic novel adaptation of detective writer, mystery writer Lawrence Block's character, Matthew Scudder, 8 Million Ways to Die. And Matthew Scudder is part of this. There's about 15, 17 plus books by Lawrence Block featuring Matthew Scudder. And I am currently working with Lawrence and his agent to do further adaptations of the Lawrence Block Matthew Scudder.
And that book is goddamn beautiful. Oh my God. Absolutely beautiful. Yep.
Thanks. And I'm very much looking, we are actively looking for new publishers to work with to do new adaptations. So I am currently working on getting that going too. So if there's anyone out there that's interested in following up with me, they know how to get a hold of me via my website or other forms of social media. And I would love to continue doing those. Really loved working on 8 Million Ways to Die and would love to continue the series.
John, talk about the Continental Op.
Yes, and also for Clover Press, who I'm doing the Fashion and Action book for, I did a Continental Op book for Clover Press, which included the first five Continental Op stories by Dashiell Hammett, preceded Sam Spade and his character Sam Spade, and those are the first five prose short stories, and I did two illustrations for each of those stories and the cover,
and that was beautiful. Wow. They're absolutely beautiful, yeah.
And that was, you know, you were talking earlier, Matt, about you know, you wish things would change the villains in Dr. Midnight and how we still deal with all that. What was fascinating about working on the Continental Op?
Yeah, that was no different either, right?
That was from the 19. That was, those stories are 100 years old, and you know, the Continental Op was an insurance investigator, and he's investigating all these, you know, crimes of passion and inter-family crimes and such. And again, it's almost as 100 years have gone by and people just have not changed.
They're just doing the same shit. Yeah.
So. Well, gentlemen, those are all amazing works. And folks, we love this Dr. Midnight book. It's 27 years old, but you should be supporting these creators today still. So please get out there, check out all those things they just mentioned. And thank you both for your time today. This has been absolutely amazing. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Jag.
Yeah, it was great doing this. Thank you so much.
Okay, I told you it was going to be amazing, right? Oh my gosh, it was so fantastic. Now, we want to hear your thoughts on the Dr. Midnight miniseries and this interview. The best way to be part of the conversation is in the comments section on our website. So just visit fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA and leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode. You can also find us on social media as JSA Presents on Blue Sky, Twitter or X, Instagram, Facebook, and Threads. And again, share your thoughts on our website comment section, and I'll be reading portions of your feedback on the next episode of this podcast. I am foregoing feedback for this particular episode, but we will catch up next time. Also, if you want more insight from Matt Wagner and John K. Snyder III on Dr. Midnight, pick up Back Issue Magazine number 170, coming in October 2026. It features an examination of Dr. Midnight, including contributions from both Matt and John, so be sure to grab your copy when it's released. I also want to take a second to thank the folks who help make these podcasts possible. This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcasts. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network. And as certain tiers you get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to this all-star squadron of supporters: Al the Comics Guy, Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keen, Jeffrey Owens, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Thank you, folks at home, so much for listening to this episode of the JSA in the 90s podcast. You can find all the back episodes as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed on your podcatcher of choice and on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We continue to release new episodes monthly celebrating the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. And once again, huge thanks to Matt Wagner and John K. Schneider III for coming on the show and sharing their amazing insight into creating the Dr. Midnight miniseries. Now come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 4 from 1991. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. That's going to do it, folks. Until next time, I'm Shag, and we're asking you to join the fight for justice.